to the array of instruments I would need for the surgery itself. Unsure, I picked up the bottle, uncorked it, and waved a hand across the neck, wafting fumes toward my nose. The result was a reassuring wave of dizziness that blurred my vision for a moment. When it cleared, I recorked the bottle and set it down, feeling somewhat more confident. Just in time. I heard voices at the back of the house and footsteps in the hall. I turned expectantly to see Mr. Christie glowering at me from the doorway, his hand curled protectively into his chest.
"I've changed my mind."
Christie lowered his brows still further to emphasize his position.
"I have considered the matter and prayed upon it, and I shall not allow you to employ your foul potions upon me."
"You stupid man," I said, thoroughly put out. I stood up and glowered back. "What is the matter with you?" He looked taken aback, as though a snake in the grass at his feet had dared to address him.
"There is nothing whatever the matter with me," he said, quite gruff.
He lifted his chin aggressively, bristling his short beard at me.
"What is the matter with you, madam?"
And I thought it was only Highlanders who were stubborn as rocks. He looked quite insulted at this comparison, but before he could take further issue with me, Jamie poked his head into the surgery, drawn by the sounds of altercation.
"Is there some difficulty?" he inquired politely.
"Yes, he refuses."
"There is.
She insists." The words collided, and we both broke off, glaring at each other. Jamie glanced from me to Mr. Christie, then at the apparatus on the table. He cast his eyes up to heaven, as though imploring guidance, then rubbed a finger thoughtfully beneath his nose.
"Aye," he said. "Well, do you want your hand mended, Tom?"
Christie went on looking mulish, cradling the crippled hand protectively against his chest. After a moment, though, he nodded, slowly.
"Aye," he said. He gave me a deeply suspicious look. "But I shall not be having any of this popish nonsense about it."
"Popish?" Jamie and I spoke at the same time, Jamie sounding merely puzzled, myself deeply exasperated.
"Aye. And you need not be thinking you can cod me into it either, Fraser."
Jamie shot me an "I told you so, Sassenach" sort of look, but squared himself to give it a try.
"Well, you always were an awkward wee bugger, Tom," he said mildly. "You must please yourself about it, to be sure. But I can tell you, from experience, that it does hurt a great deal."
I thought Christie paled a little.
"Tom, look."
Jamie nodded at the tray of instruments. Two scalpels, a probe, scissors, forceps, and two suture needles already threaded with gut and floating in a jar of alcohol. They gleamed dully in the sunlight.
"She means to cut into your hand, eh?"
"I know that," Christie snapped, although his eyes slid away from the sinister assemblage of sharp edges.
"Aye, you do. But you've not the slightest notion what it's like."
"I have.
See here."
He held up his right hand, the back of it, toward Christie and waggled it. In that position, with the morning sun full on it, the thin white scars that laced his fingers were stark against the deep bronze skin.
"What bloody hurt," he assured Christie. "You didn't want to do something like that. And there's a choice about it." "Which there is."
Christie barely glanced at the hand.
"Of course," I thought, "he would be familiar with the look of it. He'd lived with Jamie for 3 years.
"I have made my choice," Christie said with dignity. He sat down in the chair and laid his hand palm up on the napkin. All the colour had leached out of his face, and his free hand was clenched so hard that it trembled. Jamie looked at him under heavy brows for a moment, then sighed.
"Aye. Wait a moment, then." Obviously, there was no further point in argument, and I didn't bother trying.
I took down the bottle of medicinal whiskey I kept on the shelf, and poured a healthy tot into a cup. "Take a little wine for thy stomach's sake," I said, thrusting it firmly into his upturned hand. "Our mutual acquaintance, St. Paul, if it's all right to drink for the sake of a stomach,
Surely to goodness you can take a drop for the sake of a hand.
His mouth, grimly compressed in anticipation, opened in surprise. He glanced from the cup to me, then back.
He swallowed, nodded, and raised the cup to his lips.
Before he had finished, though, Jamie came back, holding a small battered green book which he thrust unceremoniously into Christie's hand. Christie looked surprised, but held the book out, squinting to see what it was. Holy Bible was printed on the warped cover.
King James version. You'll take help where you can, I suppose, Jamie said, a little gruffly.
Christie looked at him sharply, then nodded, a very faint smile passing through his beard like a shadow.
I thank you, sir, he said.
He took his spectacles out of his coat and put them on, then opened the little book with great care and began to thumb through it, evidently looking for a suitable inspiration for undergoing surgery without anaesthetic. I gave Jamie a long look, to which he responded with the faintest of shrugs. It wasn't merely a Bible. It was the Bible that had once belonged to Alexander MacGregor. Jamie had come by it as a very young man when he was imprisoned in Fort William by Captain Jonathan Randall. Flogged once, and awaiting another, frightened and in pain, he'd been left in solitary confinement with no company save his thoughts, and this Bible, given to him by the garrison's surgeon for what comfort it might offer. Alex MacGregor had been another young Scottish prisoner, one who had died by his own hand rather than suffer the further attentions of Captain Randall. His name was written inside the book, in a tidy, rather sprawling hand. The little Bible was no stranger to fear and suffering. And if it wasn't ether, I hoped it might still possess its own power of anodyne. Christie had found something that suited him. He cleared his throat, straightened himself in the chair, and laid his hand on the towel, palm up, in such a forthright manner that I wondered whether he had settled on a passage in which the Maccabees willingly present their hands and tongues for amputation at the hands of the heathen king. A peek over his shoulder indicated he was somewhere in the Psalms, though.
"At your convenience, then, Mistress Freezer," Christie said politely.
If he wasn't to be unconscious, I needed a bit of extra preparation. Manly fortitude was all very well, and so was biblical inspiration. But there are relatively few people capable of sitting motionless while having their hands sliced into, and I didn't think Thomas Christie was one of them. I had a plentiful supply of linen strips for bandaging. I rolled back his sleeve, then used a few of the strips to bind his forearm tightly to the little table, with an additional band holding back the clawed fingers from the site of operation. Though Christie seemed rather shocked at the notion of drinking liquor while reading the Bible, Jamie, and just possibly the sight of the waiting scalpels, had convinced him that circumstances justified it. He had consumed a couple of ounces by the time I had him properly secured, and his palm thoroughly swabbed with raw alcohol, and was looking significantly more relaxed than he had upon entering the room. This sense of relaxation disappeared abruptly when I made the first incision. His breath rushed out in a high-pitched gasp, and he arched upward out of the chair, jerking the table across the floor with a screech. I grabbed his wrist in time to prevent his ripping the bandages away, and Jamie seized him by both shoulders, pressing him back into the chair.
Now then, Jamie said, squeezing firmly. You'll do, Tom. Aye, you'll do.
Sweat had popped out all over Christie's face, and his eyes were huge behind the lenses of his spectacles. He gulped, swallowed, took a quick look at his hand, which was welling blood, then looked away, white as a sheet. If you're going to vomit, Mr. Christie, do it there, will you? I said, shoving an empty bucket toward him with one foot. I still had one hand on his wrist, the other pressing a wad of sterilized lint hard onto the incision. Jamie was still talking to him like one settling a panicked horse. Christie was rigid, but breathing hard and trembling in every limb, including the one I meant to be working on. "Shall I stop?" I asked Jamie, giving Christie a quick appraisal. I could feel his pulse hammering in the wrist I grasped. He wasn't in shock, quite, but plainly wasn't feeling at all well. Jamie shook his head, eyes on Christie's face.
No. Shame to waste that much whiskey, aye. And they'll not want to go through the waiting again. Here, Tom, have another dram. It'll do you good.
He pressed the cup to Christie's lips, and Christie gulped it without hesitation. Jamie had let go of Christie's shoulders as he settled. Now he took hold of Christie's forearm with one hand, gripping firmly. With the other, he picked up the Bible, which had fallen to the floor, and thumbed it open.
"The right hand of the Lord is exalted," he read, squinting over Christie's shoulder at the book. "The right hand of the Lord doeth valiantly." Well, that's appropriate, no?
He glanced down at Christie, who had subsided, his free hand clenched in a fist against his belly.
"Go on," Christie said, voice hoarse.
"I shall not die, but live, and declare the works of the Lord," Jamie went on, his voice low but firm. "The Lord hath chastened me sore, but he hath not given me over unto death."
Christie seemed to find this heartening. His breathing slowed a little. I couldn't spare time to look at him, and his arm under Jamie's grasp was hard as wood. Still, he was beginning to murmur along with Jamie, catching every few words.
"Open to me the gates of righteousness. I will praise thee, for thou hast heard me."
I had the aponeurosis laid bare and could clearly see the thickening. A flick of the scalpel freed the edge of it, then a ruthless slice cutting hard down through the fibrous band of tissue. The scalpel struck bone, and Christie gasped.
"God is the Lord which has showed us light. Bind the sacrifice with cords, even unto the horns of the altar."
I could hear a tinge of amusement in Jamie's voice as he read that bit, and felt the shift of his body as he glanced toward me. It did look rather as though I'd been sacrificing something. Hands don't bleed as profusely as head wounds, but there are plenty of small vessels in the palm, and I was hastily blotting away the blood with one hand as I worked with the other. Discarded wads of blood-stained lint littered the table and the floor around me. Jamie was flipping to and fro, picking out random bits of scripture, but Christie was with him now, speaking the words along with him. I stole a hasty glance at him. His colour was still bad, and his pulse thundering, but the breathing was better. He was clearly speaking from memory. The lenses of his spectacles were fogged. I had the hindering tissue fully exposed now, and was trimming away the tiny fibres from the surface of the tendon. The clawed fingers twitched, and the exposed tendons moved suddenly, silver as darting fish. I grabbed the feebly wiggling fingers and squeezed them firmly. "You mustn't move," I said. "I need both hands. I can't hold yours." I couldn't look up, but felt him nod and released his fingers. With the tendons gleaming softly in their beds, I removed the last bits of the aponeurosis, sprayed the wound with a mixture of alcohol and distilled water for disinfection, and set about closing the incisions. The men's voices were no more than whispers, a low susurrus to which I had paid no attention, engrossed as I was. As I relaxed my attention and began to suture the wound, though, I became aware of them again.
"The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want."
I looked up, wiping perspiration from my forehead with my sleeve, and saw that Thomas Christie now held the small Bible, closed and pressed against his body with his free arm, his chin jammed hard into his chest, his eyes tight closed, and face contorted with pain. Jamie still held the bound arm tight, but had his other hand on Christie's shoulder, his own head bent near Christie's. His eyes, too, were closed as he whispered the words.
"Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil."
I knotted the last suture, clipped the thread, and in the same movement cut through the linen bindings with my scissors, and let go the breath I'd been holding. The men's voices stopped abruptly. I lifted the hand, wrapped a fresh dressing tightly around it, and pressed the clawed fingers gently back, straightening them. Christie's eyes opened slowly. His pupils were huge and dark behind his lenses as he blinked at his hand. I smiled at him and patted it. "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life," I said softly, "and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord for ever." Chapter 24. Touch me not. Christie's pulse was a little rapid, but strong. I set down the wrist I had been holding and put the back of my hand against his forehead. "You're a bit feverish," I said. "Here, swallow this." I put a hand behind his back to help him sit up in bed, which alarmed him. He sat up in a flurry of bedclothes, drawing in his breath sharply as he jostled the injured hand. I tactfully affected not to notice his discomposure, which I put down to the fact that he was clad in his shirt and I in my nightclothes. These were modest enough, to be sure, with a light shawl covering my linen night rail, but I was reasonably sure that he hadn't been anywhere near a woman in déshabille since his wife died, if then. I murmured something meaningless, holding the cup of comfrey tea for him as he drank, and then settled his pillows in comfortable but impersonal fashion. Rather than send him back to his own cabin, I had insisted that he stay the night, so I could keep an eye on him in case of post-operative infection. Intransigent as he was by nature, I didn't by any means trust him to follow instructions, and not to be slopping hogs, cutting wood, or wiping his backside with the wounded hand. I wasn't letting him out of sight until the incision had begun to granulate, which it should do by the next day, if all went well. Still shaky from the shock of surgery, he had made no demur, and Mrs. Bug and I had put him to bed in the Weems's room, Mr. Weems and Lizzie having gone to the McGillivrays. I had no laudanum, but had slipped Christie a strong infusion of valerian and St. John's wort, and he had slept most of the afternoon. He had declined any supper, but Mrs. Bug, who approved of Mr. Christie, had been plying him through the evening with toddies, syllabubs, and other nourishing elixirs, all containing a high percentage of alcohol. Consequently, he seemed rather dazed as well as flushed, and made no protest as I picked up the bandaged hand and brought the candle close to examine it. The hand was swollen, which was to be expected, but not excessively so. Still, the bandage was tight and cutting uncomfortably into the flesh. I snipped it, and holding the honeyed dressing that covered the wound carefully in place, lifted the hand and sniffed at it. I could smell honey, blood, herbs, and the faintly metallic scent of fresh severed flesh, but no sweet whiff of pus. Good. I pressed carefully near the dressing, watching for signs of sharp pain or streaks of vivid red in the skin. But bar a reasonable tenderness, I saw only a small degree of inflammation. Still, he was feverish. It would bear watching. I took a fresh length of bandage and wound it carefully over the dressing, finishing with a neat bow at the back of the hand.
"Why do you never wear a proper kerch or cap?" he blurted.
"What?" I looked up in surprise, having temporarily forgotten the man attached to the hand. I put my free hand to my head. "Why should I?" I sometimes plaited my hair before bed, but hadn't tonight. I had brushed it, though, and it floated loose around my shoulders, smelling pleasantly of the hyssop and nettle flower infusion I combed through it to keep lice at bay.
"Why?"
His voice rose a little.
"Every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered dishonoureth her head, for that is even all one as if she was shaven."
"Oh, are we back to Paul again?" I murmured, returning my attention to his hand.
"Does it not occur to you that that man had rather a bee in his bonnet when it came to women?
Besides, I'm not praying at the moment, and I want to see how this does overnight, before I risk any prophesying about it. So far, though, it seems..."
Your hair.
I looked up to see him staring at me, mouth curved downward in disapproval.
It's...
He made a vague movement round his own clipped poll.
It's...
I raised my brows at him.
There's a great deal of it, he ended, rather feebly.
I eyed him for a moment, then put down his hand and reached for the little green Bible which was sitting on the table. Corinthians, was it? Hmm. Oh, yes. Here we are. I straightened my back and read the verse. Doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him? But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. I closed the book with a snap and set it down. Would you care to step across the landing and explain to my husband how shameful his hair is? I asked politely. Jamie had gone to bed. A faint rhythmic snoring was audible from our room. Or do you expect he knows that already? Christie was already flushed from drink and fever. At this, an ugly dark red washed him from chest to hairline. His mouth moved, opening and closing soundlessly. I didn't wait for him to decide on something to say, but merely turned my attention back to his hand. Now, I said firmly, you must do exercise regularly to make sure that the muscles don't contract as they heal. It will be painful at first, but you must do it. Let me show you. I took hold of his ring finger, just below the first joint, and, keeping the finger itself straight, bent the top joint a little inward. Do you see? Here, you do it. Take hold with your other hand, and then try to bend just that one joint. Yes, that's it. Do you feel the pull down through the palm of your hand? That's just what's wanted. Now, do it with the little finger. Yes. Yes, that's very good. I looked up and smiled at him. The flush had faded a little, but he still looked thoroughly nonplussed. He didn't smile back at me, but glanced hastily away, down at his hand. Right. Now put your hand flat on the table. Yes, that's the way. And try to raise your fourth finger and little finger by themselves. Yes, I know it isn't easy. Keep trying, though. Are you hungry, Mr. Christie?
His stomach had given a loud growl, startling him as much as me.
I suppose I might eat,
he mumbled ungraciously, scowling at his uncooperative hand. I'll fetch you something. Keep trying those exercises for a bit, why don't you? The house was quiet, settled for the night. Warm as it was, the shutters had been left open, and enough moonlight streamed through the windows that I didn't need to light a candle. A shadow detached itself from the darkness in my surgery and followed me down the hallway to the kitchen. And so, leaving off his nocturnal hunt for mice in hopes of easier prey. Hello, cat, I said, as he slithered past my ankles into the pantry. If you think you're having any of the ham, think again. I might go as far as a saucer of milk, though. The milk jug was white earthenware with a blue band round it, a squat, pale shape floating in the darkness. I poured out a saucer and put it down on the floor for Adso, then set about assembling a light supper. Aware that Scottish expectations of a light meal involved sufficient food to founder a horse. Ham, cold fried potatoes, cold fried mush, bread and butter, I chanted under my breath, shovelling it all onto a large wooden tray. Rabbit dumpling, tomato pickle, a bit of raisin pie for pudding. What else? I glanced down toward the soft lapping noises coming from the shadows at my feet. I'd give him milk too, but he wouldn't drink it. Well, we might as well keep on as we started, I suppose. It will help him to sleep. I reached for the whiskey decanter and put that on the tray as well. A faint scent of ether floated in the dark air of the hallway as I made my way back toward the stairs. I sniffed suspiciously. had Adso tipped over the bottle.
No, it wasn't strong enough for that, I decided. Just a few wayward molecules seeping round the cork. I was simultaneously relieved and regretful that Mr. Christie had refused to let me use the ether. Relieved because there was no telling how it might have worked. Or not. Regretful because I would have liked very much to add the gift of unconsciousness to my arsenal of skills. A precious gift to bestow on future patients. And one I should very much have liked to give Mr. Christie. Beyond the fact that the surgery had hurt him badly, it was very much more difficult to operate on a conscious person. The muscles were tensed, adrenaline was flooding through the system, heart rate was vastly speeded up, causing blood to spurt rather than flow. For the dozenth time since the morning, I envisioned exactly what I had done, asking myself whether I might have done better. To my surprise, Christie was still doing the exercises. His face was sheened with sweat, and his mouth set grimly, but he was still doggedly bending the joints. "That's very good," I said. "Do stop now, though. I don't want you to start bleeding again." I picked up the napkin automatically and blotted the sweat from his temples.
"Is there someone else in the house?" he asked, irritably jerking his head away from my ministrations. "I heard you speaking to someone downstairs."
"Oh," I said, rather embarrassed. "No, just the cat."
Prompted by this introduction, Adso, who had followed me upstairs, leapt onto the bed and stood kneading the covers with his paws, big green eyes fixed on the plate of ham. Christie turned a gaze of deep suspicion from the cat to me.
"No, he is not my familiar," I said tartly, scooping up Adso and dumping him unceremoniously on the floor. "He's a cat. Talking to him is slightly less ridiculous than talking to myself, that's all."
An expression of surprise flitted across Christie's face. Perhaps surprise that I had read his mind, or simple surprise at my idiocy. But the creases of suspicion round his eyes relaxed. I cut up his food with brisk efficiency, but he insisted upon feeding himself. He ate clumsily with his left hand, eyes on his plate, and brows knotted in concentration. When he had finished, he drank off a cup of whiskey as though it were water, set down the empty cup, and looked at me.
"Mistress Fraser," he said, speaking very precisely, "I am an educated man. I do not think you are a witch."
"Oh, you don't," I said, rather amused.
"So you don't believe in witches?"
"But there are witches mentioned in the Bible, you know." He stifled a belch with his fist and regarded me fishily.
"I did not say I do not believe in witches. I do. I said ye aren't one. Aye?"
"I'm very much obliged to hear it," I said, trying not to smile. He was quite drunk. Though his speech was even more precise than usual, his accent had begun to slip. Normally he suppressed the inflections of his native Edinburgh as much as possible, but it was growing broader by the moment. "A bit more?" I didn't wait for an answer, but poured a solid tot of whiskey into his empty cup. The shutters were open, and the room was cool, but sweat still gleamed in the creases of his neck. He was clearly in pain, and wasn't likely to sleep again without help. He sipped at it this time, watching me over the rim of the cup as I tidied up the supper leavings. In spite of whiskey and a full stomach, he was increasingly restive, shifting his legs beneath the quilt and twitching his shoulders. "I thought he needed the chamber pot, and was debating whether I ought to offer to help him with it, or simply leave promptly so he could manage by himself. The latter, I thought." I was mistaken, though. Before I could excuse myself, he set down his cup on the table and sat up straight in bed.
"Mistress Fraser," he said, fixing me with a beady eye, "I wish to apologize to you."
"What for?" I said, startled. his lips pressed tight.
"For my behaviour this morning."
"Oh, well, that's quite all right. I can see how the idea of being put to sleep must seem quite peculiar to you."
"I didn't mean that."
He glanced up sharply, then down again.
"I meant that I could not keep myself still."
I saw the deepening flush rise up his cheeks again, and had a sudden pang of surprised sympathy. He was truly embarrassed. I set down the tray and sat down slowly on the stool beside him, wondering what I could say that might assuage his feelings and not make matters worse. "But Mr. Christie," I said, "I wouldn't expect anyone to hold still while having their hand taken apart. It's simply not human nature." He shot me a quick, fierce glance.
"Not even your husband?"
I blinked, taken aback. Not so much by the words as by the tone of bitterness. Roger had told me a bit of what Kenny Lindsay had said about Ardsmuir. It had been no secret that Christie had been envious of Jamie's leadership then. But what had that to do with this?
"What makes you say that?" I asked quietly.
I took his injured hand, ostensibly to check the bindings. In fact, merely to give me somewhere to look other than into his eyes.
"It's true, eh? Your husband's hand?"
His beard jutted pugnaciously at me.
"He said you'd mended it for him. He didn't wriggle and squirm when you did it now, did he?"
"Well, no, he hadn't. Jamie had prayed, cursed, sweated, cried, and screamed once or twice. But he hadn't moved." Jamie's hand wasn't a matter I wanted to discuss with Thomas Christie, though. "Everyone's different," I said, giving him as straight a look as I could. "I wouldn't expect..."
"You wouldn't expect any man to do as well as him."
"Aye, I ken that."
The dull red colour was burning in his cheeks again, and he looked down at his bandaged hand. The fingers of his good hand were clenched in a fist.
"That's not what I meant," I protested. "Not at all. I've stitched wounds and set bones for a good many men. Almost all the Highlanders were terribly brave about..."
It occurred to me that a fraction of a second too late that Christie was not a Highlander. He made a deep growling noise in his throat.
"Highlanders," he said,
in a tone that made it clear he would have liked to spit on the floor had he not been in the presence of a lady.
"Barbarians," I said, responding to the tone.
He glanced at me, and I saw his mouth twist as he had his own moment of belated realization. He looked away and took a deep breath.
I smelled the gust of whiskey as he let it out. "Your husband is certainly a gentleman. He comes of a noble family, if one tainted by treason."
The R's of treason rolled like thunder. He really was quite drunk.
"But he is also...
He frowned, groping for a better word, then gave it up.
"One of them. Surely you ken that, and you an Englishwoman."
"One of them," I repeated, mildly amused. "You mean a Highlander or a barbarian?" He gave me a look somewhere between triumph and puzzlement.
"The same thing, is it not?"
I rather thought he had a point. While I had met Highlanders of wealth and education, like Colum and Dougal Mackenzie, to say nothing of Jamie's grandfather, the treasonous Lord Lovett to whom Christie was referring, the fact was that every single one of them had the instincts of a Viking freebooter. And to be perfectly honest, so did Jamie.
"Ah, well, they, do tend to be rather..." I began feebly.
I rubbed a finger under my nose.
"Well, they are raised to be fighting men, I suppose."
"Or is that what you mean?" He sighed deeply and shook his head a little,
though I thought it wasn't in disagreement, but simply in dismay at the contemplation of Highland customs and manners. Mr. Christie was himself well-educated, the son of a self-made Edinburgh merchant. As such, he had pretensions, painful ones, to being a gentleman, but would obviously never make a proper barbarian. I could see why Highlanders both puzzled and annoyed him. What must it have been like, I wondered, for him to find himself imprisoned alongside a horde of uncouth, by his standards, violent, flamboyant Catholic barbarians, treated, or mistreated, as one of them. He had leaned back a little on his pillow, eyes closed and mouth compressed. Without opening his eyes, he asked suddenly,
"Do you ken that your husband bears the stripes of flogging?"
I opened my mouth to reply tartly that I had been married to Jamie for nearly 30 years, when I realized that the question implied something about the nature of Mr. Christie's own concept of marriage that I didn't want to consider too closely. "I know," I said instead, briefly, with a quick glance toward the open door. "Why?" Christie opened his eyes, which were a little unfocused. With some effort, he brought his gaze to bear on me.
"You know why?" he asked, slurring a little. "Why dead?"
I felt heat rise in my cheeks on Jamie's behalf.
"Erard's Muir,"
Christie said, before I could answer, levelling a finger at me. He poked it at the air, almost in accusation.
"He claimed a bit of tartan, aye? Forbidden."
"Aye," I said, in baffled reflex. "I mean, did he?" Christie shook his head slowly back and forth, looking like a large intoxicated owl, eyes fixed now and glaring.
"Not his," he said. "A young lad's."
He opened his mouth to speak further, but only a soft belch emerged from it, surprising him. He closed his mouth and blinked, then tried again.
"It was an act of extraordinary nobility and courage."
He looked at me and shook his head slightly.
Incomprehensible.
Incomprehensible? How he did it, you mean? I knew how, all right. Jamie was so bloody-mindedly stubborn that he would see out any action he intended, no matter whether hell itself barred the way or what happened to him in the process. But surely Christie knew that about him.
"Not how."
Christie's head lolled a little, and he pulled it upright with an effort.
"Why?"
"Why? I wanted to say, because he's an effing hero, that's why, he can't help it. But that wouldn't really have been right. Besides, I didn't know why Jamie had done it. He hadn't told me, and I did wonder why not." "He'd do anything to protect one of his men," I said instead. Christie's gaze was rather glassy, but still intelligent. He looked at me for a long moment, unspeaking, thoughts passing slowly behind his eyes. A floorboard in the hall creaked, and I strained my ears for Jamie's breathing. Yes, I could hear it, soft and regular. He was still asleep.
"Does he think that I am one of his men?" Christie asked at last.
His voice was low, but full of both incredulity and outrage.
"Because I am not. I assure you."
I began to think that last glass of whiskey had been a grave mistake.
"No,"
I said with a sigh, repressing the urge to close my eyes and rub my forehead. "I'm sure he doesn't. If you mean that," I nodded at the little Bible, "I'm sure it was simple kindness. He'd do as much for any stranger. You would yourself, wouldn't you?" He breathed heavily for a bit, glaring, but then nodded once and lay back, as though exhausted. as well he might be. All the belligerence had gone out of him as suddenly as air from a balloon, and he looked somehow smaller and rather forlorn.
"I am sorry," he said softly.
He lifted his bandaged hand a little and let it fall. I wasn't sure whether he was apologizing for his remarks about Jamie or for what he saw as his lack of bravery in the morning. I thought it wiser not to inquire, though, and stood up, smoothing down the linen night rail over my thighs. I pulled the quilt up a bit and tugged it straight, then blew out the candle. He was no more than a dark shape against the pillows, his breathing slow and hoarse. "You did very well," I whispered, and patted his shoulder. "Good night, Mr. Christie." My personal barbarian was asleep, but woke, cat-like, when I crawled into bed. He stretched out an arm and gathered me into himself with a sleepily interrogative, "Hmm?" I nestled against him, tight muscles beginning to relax automatically into his warmth. "Hmm.
Ah, and how's our wee Tom, then?"
He leaned back a little, and his big hands came down on my trapezius, kneading the knots from my neck and shoulders. "Oh. Ooh. Obnoxious, prickly, censorious, and very drunk. Otherwise, fine. Oh, yes. More, please. Up a bit. Oh, yes. Ooh."
"Aye, well, that sounds like Tom at his best, bar the drunkenness. If you groan like that, Sassenach, you'll think I'm rubbing something other than your neck."
"I do not care," I said, eyes closed, the better to appreciate the exquisite sensations vibrating through my spinal column. "I've had quite enough of Tom Christie for the moment. Besides, he's likely passed out by now, with as much as he's had to drink." Still, I tempered my vocal response in the interests of my patient's rest. "Where did that Bible come from?" I asked, though the answer was obvious. Jenny must have sent it from Lallybroch. Her last parcel had arrived a few days before, while I was visiting Salem. Jamie answered the question I'd really asked, sighing so his breath stirred my hair.
"It gave me a queer turn to see it when I came to it among the books my sister sent. I couldn't quite decide what to do with it, I."
Little wonder if it had given him a turn. "Why did she send it? Did she say?" My shoulders were beginning to relax, the ache between them dulling. I felt him shrug behind me.
"She sent it with some other books, said she was turning out the attic and found a box of them, so decided to send them to me. But she did mention hearing that the village of Kildenny had decided to emigrate to North Carolina. They're all MacGregors up near there, Ken."
"Oh, I see." Jamie had once told me that his intention was one day to find the mother of Alex MacGregor and give her his Bible, with the information that her son had been avenged. He had made inquiries after Culloden, but discovered that both of the MacGregor parents were dead. Only a sister remained alive, and she had married and left her home. No one knew quite where she was, or even whether she was still in Scotland.
"Do you think Jenny, or Ian, rather, found the sister at last? And she lived in that village?"
He shrugged again, and with a final squeeze of my shoulders, left off.
"That may be. You ken Jenny. She'd leave it to me whether to search for the woman."
"And will you?" I rolled over to face him. Alex MacGregor had hanged himself rather than live as prey to Black Jack Randall. Jack Randall was dead, had died at Culloden, but Jamie's memories of Culloden were no more than fragments, driven from him by the trauma of the battle and the fever he had suffered afterward. He had waked, wounded, with Jack Randall's body lying on top of him, but had no recollection of what had happened. And yet I supposed Alex MacGregor had been avenged.
whether or not by Jamie's hand. He thought about that for a moment, and I felt the small stirring as he tapped the two stiff fingers of his right hand against his thigh.
"I'll ask," he said finally. "Her name was Mary."
"I see," I said. "Well, there can't be more than, 300 or 400 women named Mary in North Carolina."
That made him laugh, and we drifted off to sleep to the accompaniment of Tom Christie's stertorous snores across the hall. It might have been minutes or hours later that I woke suddenly, listening. The room was dark, the fire cold on the hearth, and the shutters rattling faintly. I tensed a little, trying to wake enough to rise and go to my patient, but then heard him, a long wheezing inspiration followed by a rumbling snore. It wasn't that that had awakened me, I realized. It was the sudden silence beside me. Jamie was lying stiff beside me, scarcely breathing. I put out a hand slowly, so he wouldn't be shocked at the touch, and rested it on his leg. He hadn't had nightmares for some months, but I recognized the signs. "What is it?" I whispered. He drew breath a little deeper than usual, and his body seemed momentarily to draw in upon itself. I didn't move, but left my hand on his leg, feeling the muscle flex microscopically beneath my fingers, a tiny intimation of flight. He didn't flee, though. He moved his shoulders in a brief, violent twitch, then let out his breath and settled into the mattress. He didn't speak for a bit, but his weight drew me closer, like a moon pulled near to its planet. I lay quiet, my hand on him, my hip against his, flesh of his flesh. He stared upward into the shadows between the beams. I could see the line of his profile, and the shine of his eyes as he blinked now and then. "In the dark," he whispered at last. "There, at Ardsmuir. We lay in the dark. Sometimes there was a moon or starlight, but even then you couldn't see anything on the floor where we lay. It was naught but black. But you could hear. Hear the breathing of the 40 men in the cell, and the shuffles and shifts of their movements, snores, coughing, the sounds of restless sleep, and the small furtive sounds from those who lay awake. It would be weeks, and we wouldn't think of it." His voice was coming easier now. "We were always starved, cold, worn to the bone. You didn't think much then, only of how to put one foot in front of another, lift another stone. You didn't really want to think, Ken. And it's easy enough not to, for a time. But every now and then something would change. The fog of exhaustion would lift suddenly without warning. Sometimes you kent what it was. A story someone told, maybe, or a letter that came from someone's wife or sister. Sometimes it came out of nowhere. No one said a thing. But you'd wake to it in the night, like the smell of a woman lying next to you. Memory, longing, need. They became men touched by fire, roused from dull acceptance by the sudden searing recollection of loss. Everyone would go a bit mad for a time. There would be fights all the time. And at night, in the dark. At night you would hear the sounds of desperation, stifled sobs or stealthy rustlings. Some men would, in the end, reach out to another, sometimes to be rebuffed with shouts and blows. Sometimes not. I wasn't sure what he was trying to tell me, nor what it had to do with Thomas Christie, or perhaps Lord John Grey. Did any of them ever touch you? I asked tentatively. No. None of them would ever think to touch me, he said very softly. I was their chief. They loved me, but they wouldn't think
ever to touch me.
He took a deep, ragged breath.
And did you want them to? I whispered.
I could feel my own pulse begin to throb in my fingertips against his skin.
I hungered for it, he said, so softly I could barely hear him, close as I was. More than food, more than sleep, though I wished most desperately for sleep, and not only for the sake of tiredness. For when I slept, sometimes I saw you. But it was neither longing for a woman, though Christ knows that was bad enough. It was only I wanted the touch of a hand. Only that.
His skin had ached with need till he felt it must grow transparent and the raw soreness of his heart be seen in his chest. He made a small, rueful sound, not quite a laugh.
Again those pictures of the Sacred Heart, the same as we saw in Paris. I knew them, Renaissance paintings, and the vividness of stained glass glowing in the aisles of Notre Dame.
The man of sorrows, his heart exposed and pierced, radiant with love.
I remembered that, and I thought to myself that whoever saw that vision of our Lord was likely a very lonely man himself, to have understood so well.
I lifted my hand and laid it on the small hollow in the centre of his chest, very lightly. The sheet was thrown back, and his skin was cool. He closed his eyes, sighing, and clasped my hand hard.
The thought of that would come to me sometimes, and I would think I kent what Jesus must feel like there. So wanting, and no one to touch him.
Chapter 25. Ashes to Ashes. Jamie checked his saddlebags once more, though he had done it so often of late that the exercise was little more than custom. Each time he opened the left-hand one, he still smiled, though. Brianna had remade it for him, stitching in loops of leather that presented his pistols, hilt up, ready to be seized in an emergency, and a clever arrangement of compartments that held handy his shot pouch, powder horn, a spare knife, a coil of fishing line, a roll of twine for a snare, a huzzive, with pins, needles and thread, a packet of food, a bottle of beer, and a neatly rolled clean shirt. On the outside of the bag was a small pouch that held what Bree was pleased to call a first aid kit, though he was unsure what it was meant to be in aid of. It contained several gauze packets of a bitter-smelling tea, a tin of salve, and several strips of her adhesive plaster, none of which seemed likely to be of use in any imaginable misadventure, but did no harm. He removed a cake of soap she had added, along with a few more unnecessary fripperies, and carefully hid them under a bucket, lest she be offended.
Just in time, too. He heard her voice exhorting Wee Roger about the inclusion of sufficient clean stockings in his bags.
By the time they came round the corner of the hay barn, he had everything securely buckled up.
"Ready then, Naharich?"
"Oh, aye," Roger nodded, and slung the saddlebags he was carrying on his shoulder off onto the ground. He turned to Bree, who was carrying Jemmy, and kissed her briefly.
"I go with you, Daddy,"
Jem exclaimed hopefully.
"Not this time, sport.
Want to see Indians?"
"Later, perhaps, when you're bigger."
"I can talk Indian. Uncle Ian tell me. Want to go?"
"Not this time," Bree told him firmly. But he wasn't inclined to listen, and began struggling to get down. Jamie made a small rumble in his throat and fixed him with a quelling eye.
"You've heard your parents," he said.
Jem glowered and stuck out his lower lip like a shelf, but ceased his fuss.
"Some day you must tell me how you do that," Roger said, eyeing his offspring.
Jamie laughed and leaned down to Jemmy.
"Kiss Grandad goodbye, eh?"
Disappointment generously abandoned, Jemmy reached up and seized him round the neck. He picked the little boy up out of Brianna's arms, hugged him, and kissed him. Jem smelled of parch, toast and honey, a homely, warm and heavy weight in his arms.
"Be good and mind your mother, aye. And when you're a wee bit bigger, you'll come too. Come and say farewell to Clarence. You can tell him the words Uncle Ian taught you." And God willing, they'd be words suitable for a 3-year-old child. Ian had a most irresponsible sense of humour. Or perhaps, he thought, grinning to himself, "I'm only recalling some of the things I'd taught Jenny's bairns, including Ian, to say in French."
He'd already saddled and bridled Roger's horse, and Clarence the pack mule was fully loaded. Brianna was checking the girth and stirrup leathers, while Roger slung his saddlebags, more to keep herself busy than because of any need. Her lower lip was caught in her teeth. She was being careful not to seem worried, but was fooling no one. Jamie took Jem up to pat the mule's nose, in order to give the lass and her man a moment's privacy. Clarence was a good sort, and suffered Jem's enthusiastic patting and mispronounced Cherokee phrases with long-suffering tolerance. But when Jem turned in his arms toward Gideon, Jamie leaned back sharply. "Nay, lad, you dinna want to touch yon wicked bugger. He'd take your hand right off." Gideon twitched his ears and stamped once, impatient. The big stallion was dying to get underway and have another chance at killing him.
"Why do you keep that vicious thing?" Brianna asked, seeing Gideon's long lip wrinkle back to show his yellow teeth in anticipation.
She took Jemmy from him, stepping well away from Gideon.
"What? Wee Gideon? Oh, we get on. Besides, he's half my trade goods, lass."
"Really?"
She gave the big chestnut a suspicious glance.
"Are you sure you won't start a war, giving the Indian something like him?"
"Oh, I didn't mean to give him to them," he assured her. "Not directly, at least."
Gideon was a bad-tempered, thrawn-headed rooster of a horse, with a mouth like iron and a will to match. However, these unsociable qualities seemed most appealing to the Indians, as did the stallion's massive chest, long wind, and stoutly muscled frame. When Quiet Air, the sachem in one of the villages, had offered him 3 deerskins for the chance to breed his spotted mare to Gideon, Jamie had realized suddenly that he had something here.
"'Twas the greatest good fortune that I never found the time to castrate him," he said, slapping Gideon familiarly on the withers and dodging by reflex as the stallion whipped his head round to snap. "He earns his keep and more, standing at stud to the Indian ponies. It's the only thing I've ever asked him to do that he's not balked at."
The lass was as pink as a Christmas rose from the morning cold. She laughed at that, though, going an even deeper colour.
"What's castrate?" Jemmy inquired.
"Your mother will tell you."
He grinned at her, ruffled Jemmy's hair, and turned to Roger.
"Ready, lad?"
Roger Mack nodded and stepped up into his stirrup, swinging aboard. He had a steady old bay gelding named Agrippa, who tended to grunt and wheeze, but was sound enough for all that, and good for a rider like Roger, competent enough, but with an abiding sense of inner reservation about horses. Roger leaned down from the saddle for a last kiss from Brianna, and they were underway. Jamie had taken a private and thorough leave of Claire earlier. She was in the window of their bedroom, watching out to wave to them as they rode past, her hairbrush in her hand. Her hair was standing out in a great curly swash round her head, and the early morning sun caught in it like flames in a thorn bush. It gave him a sudden queer feeling to see her thus so disordered, half naked in her shift. A sense of strong desire, despite what he'd done to her not an hour past, and something, almost fear, as though he might never see her again. Quite without thought, he glanced at his left hand and saw the ghost of the scar at the base of his thumb, the sea so faded that it was scarcely visible. He hadn't noticed it or thought of it in years, and felt suddenly as though there was not enough air to breathe. He waved, though, and she threw him a mocking kiss, laughing.
Christ, he'd marked her.
He could see the dark patch of the love bite he'd left on her neck, and a hot flush of embarrassment rose in his face. He dug his heels into Gideon's side, causing the stallion to give a squeal of displeasure and turn round to try to bite him in the leg. With this distraction, they were safe away. He looked back only once at the trailhead to see her still there, framed by light. She lifted one hand as though in benediction, and then the trees hid her from sight. The weather was fair, though cold for as early in the autumn as it was. The horses' breath steamed as they made their way down from the ridge through the tiny settlement folk now called Cooperville, and along the Great Buffalo Trail to the north. He kept an eye on the sky. It was much too early for snow, but heavy rains were not uncommon. What clouds there were mare's tails, though. No cause for worry. They didn't speak much, each man alone with his thoughts. Roger Mack was easy company for the most part. Jamie did miss Ian, though. He would have liked to talk over the situation as it stood now, with Sisqua. Ian understood the minds of Indians better than most white men, and while Jamie understood Bird's gesture of sending the hermit's bones well enough, it was meant as a proof of his continuing goodwill towards settlers. If the king should send them guns, he would have valued Ian's opinion. And while it was necessary that he introduce Roger Mack in the villages for the sake of future relations, well, he blushed at the thought of having to explain to the man about... Damn Ian! The lad had simply gone in the night a few days past, him and his dog. He'd done it before, and would doubtless be back as suddenly as he'd gone. Whatever darkness he'd brought back from the north would now and then become too much for him, and he would vanish into the wood, coming back silent and withdrawn, but somewhat more at peace with himself. Jamie understood it well enough. Solitude was in its own way a balm for loneliness, and whatever memory the lad was fleeing or seeking in the wood. "Has he ever spoken to you about them?" Claire had asked him, troubled. "His wife? His child?" He had not. Ian didn't speak of anything about his time among the Mohawk, and the only token he had brought back from the north was an armlet made of blue and white wampum shells. Jamie had caught a glimpse of it in Ian's sporran once, but not enough to tell the pattern of it. "Blessed Michael defend you, lad," he thought silently toward Ian. "And me the angels mend you." With one thing and another, he had no real conversation with Roger Mack until they stopped for their noon meal. They ate the fresh stuff the women had sent, enjoying it. Enough for supper left. Next day, it would be corn dodgers and anything that came across their path that could be easily caught and cooked. And one day more, and the snowbird women would have them royally fed as representatives of the King of England. "Last time it was ducks, stuffed with yams and corn," he told Roger. "It's manners to eat as much as you can, mind, no matter what's served, and you're the guest." "Got it," Roger smiled faintly, then looked down at the half-eaten sausage roll in his hand. "About that, guests, I mean. There's a wee problem, I think, with Hiram Crombie."
"Hiram?"
Jamie was surprised.
"What's to do with Hiram?"
Roger's mouth twitched, unsure whether to laugh or not.
"Well, it's only... You ken everybody's calling the bones we buried Ephraim, aye? It's all Bree's fault, but there it is."
Jamie nodded, curious.
"Well, so, yesterday Hiram came along to me and said he'd been studying upon the matter, praying and the like, and had come to the conclusion that if it were true that some of the Indians were his wife's kin, then it stood to reason that some of them must be saved as well."
"Oh, aye?"
Amusement began to kindle in his own breast.
"Yes. And so he says he feels called upon to bring these hapless savages the word of Christ,
for how else are they to hear it?
Jamie rubbed a knuckle over his upper lip, torn now between amusement and dismay at the thought of Hiram Crombie invading the Cherokee villages, psalm book in hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, but do you not believe, Presbyterians, I mean, that it's all predestined? That some are saved, I mean, and some damned, and not a thing to be done about it? Which is why the papists are all bound for hell in a handbasket.
Ah, well...
Roger hesitated, clearly not quite willing to put the matter so boldly himself.
Mm-hmm. There may be some difference of opinion among Presbyterians, I imagine. But yes, that's more or less what Hiram and his cohorts think.
Aye. Well, then, if he thinks some of the Indians must be saved already, why must they be preached to?
Roger rubbed a finger between his brows.
Well, do you see... That's the same reason Presbyterians pray and go to kirk and all. Even if they're saved, they feel they want to praise God for it and learn to do better, so as to live as God wishes them to, in gratitude for their salvation. See?
I rather think Hiram Crombie's God might take a dim view of the Indian way of living, Jamie said, with vivid memories of naked bodies in the dimness of ember glow. And the smell of furs.
Quite, Roger said,
catching Claire's dry tone so exactly that Jamie laughed.
Aye, I see the difficulty, he said.
And he did, though he still found it funny.
So Hiram means to go to the Cherokee villages and preach, is that it?
Roger nodded, swallowing a bit of sausage.
To be more exact, he wants you to take him there and make introduction for him. He wouldn't expect you to interpret the preaching, he says. Holy God!
He took a moment to contemplate this prospect, then shook his head decidedly.
No. Of course not.
Roger pulled the cork from a bottle of beer and offered it to him.
I just thought I should tell you, so you can decide best what to say to him when he asks.
Very thoughtful of you, Jamie said,
and taking the bottle, drank deeply. He lowered it, took breath, and froze. He saw Roger Mack's head turn sharply and knew he had caught it too, borne on the chilly breeze. Roger Mack turned back to him, black brows furrowed.
"Do you smell something burning?" he said.
Roger heard them first, a raucous caucus of cries and cackles, shrill as witches. Then a clappering of wings as they came in sight, and the birds flew up, mostly crows, but here and there a huge black raven.
"Oh, God," he said softly.
Two bodies hung from a tree beside the house. What was left of them? He could tell that it was a man and a woman, but only by their clothes. A piece of paper was pinned to the man's leg, so crumpled and stained that he saw it only because one edge lifted in the breeze. Jamie ripped it off, unfolded it enough to read, and threw it on the ground.
"Death to regulators," it read.
He saw the scrawl for an instant before the wind blew it away.
"Where are the bairns?" Jamie asked, turning sharply to him. "These folk have children. Where are they?"
The ashes were cold, already scattering in the wind, but the smell of burning filled him, clogged his breathing, seared his throat so that words rasped like gravel, meaningless as the scrape of pebbles underfoot. Roger tried to speak, cleared his throat, and spat.
"Hiding, maybe," he rasped,
and flung out an arm toward the wood.
"Aye, maybe."
Jamie stood abruptly, called into the wood, and, not waiting for an answer, set off into the trees, calling again. Roger followed, sheering off as they reached the forest's edge, going upslope behind the house, both of them shouting words of reassurance that were swallowed up at once by the forest's silence. Roger stumbled through the trees, sweating, panting, heedless of the pain in his throat as he shouted, barely stopping long enough to hear if anyone answered. Several times he saw movement from the corner of his eye and swung toward it,
only to see nothing but the ripple of wind through a patch of drying sedges, or a dangling creeper swaying as though someone had passed that way. He half imagined he was seeing Jem playing at hide-and-seek, and the vision of a darting foot, sun gleaming off a small head, lent him strength to shout again and yet again. At last, though, he was forced to admit that children wouldn't have run so far, and he circled back toward the cabin, still calling intermittently in hoarse, strangled croaks. He came back into the dooryard to find Jamie stooping for a rock, which he threw with great force at a pair of ravens that had settled in the hanging tree, edging, bright-eyed, back toward its burden. The ravens squawked and flapped away, but only so far as the next tree, where they sat, watching. The day was cold, but both of them